Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I am your New Books Network host, Lavinia Stan, here in Nova Scotia, Canada. We are talking today with Dr. Adam Lajeunesse, Professor of Public Policy at St. Francis Xavier University in Atlantic Canada. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Lavinia. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to talk with me about your book, Lock, Stock and Icebergs, A History of Canada's Arctic Maritime Sovereignty, which was published with the University of British Columbia Press in 2016. Adam is an associate professor at the Mulroney Institute of Government here at St. Francis Xavier University, where he is also known as one of the pillars of the public policy program, teaching courses that are attended by scores of students each year. A former Irving Shipbuilding Chair in Canadian Arctic Maritime Security Policy, Adam has an impressive research record, which spans historical and current issues across a number of themes and disciplines, public policy and history, and which includes three authors' books, six co-edited volumes and collections, more than a dozen book chapters, and numerous peer-reviewed articles and reports. For example, besides the book which we will discuss today, Adam also participated with others in writing a book on China's Arctic aspirations, the emerging interests of a near Arctic state, and what they mean for Canada, which was published with University of Calgary Press in 2018, and another one on Canadian Armed Forces Arctic Operations 1941-2015, Historical and Contemporary Lessons Learned, which appeared in Fredericton at the Gregg Center in 2017. In addition, Adam prepared collections of documents relevant for the history of Canadian Arctic sovereignty and security, which I'm sure helped people like me with little knowledge of the Arctic to understand Canada's involvement in it. He works on questions of Arctic sovereignty and security policy and has written extensively on the Arctic operations of the Canadian Armed Forces, maritime security, Canadian-American cooperation in the North, and Canadian Arctic history. He is a fellow of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute and the Arctic Institute of North America, both of them based in Calgary, as well as a fellow of the Center for the Study of Security and Development at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Adam sits on the editorial board of the Canadian Naval Review and of the journal Arctic. Adam, hello.
Hello, Lavinia.
Thank you again for accepting this invitation.
Thank you for that kind introduction.
Good. I'm very happy. I'm very happy to have this discussion today. I know that you advise the Canadian Senate. Could you tell us more about the context that brought you to Ottawa? And what did you tell the senators?
Sure. Well, over the last several years, I've spoken to several Senate and House of Commons committees studying Arctic security and maritime security policy, which isn't uncommon for academics. What senators and MPs are looking for from people like us is a bit of clarity and a little bit more nuance from what they would normally hear coming through the daily news feeds. If you open the newspaper, you're going to see Arctic stories about shipping, the Russians, the Chinese, a little bit of fear mongering here and there, a little bit of sovereignty crisis here and there. All very general, not a lot of support, I think, you would get from the popular media. And so where academics contribute to government policy discussions is providing a bit of background and nuance. And so after particularly the most recent invasion of Ukraine by Russian forces, the big question is, well, what is the security dynamic in the Canadian Arctic? What is the threat? There's a lot of discussion about Russia being a very general threat to Canada and NATO. Russia is, of course, our Arctic neighbor. So what does that look like in the real world? How does that play out? We can assume the existence of a threat, but what sort of threat? How would it emerge? The same thing with China. China has shown a great deal of interest in the Arctic, a lot of investment, a lot of scientific operations. And so what senators and MPs hear from day to day is simply, well, China is very generally a competitor of the West. Ipso facto, in the Arctic, there may be a danger. Well, what does that look like? Is it an economic danger? Is it a political danger? Are we talking about illegal fishing? Are we talking about trespassing? Are we talking about hard defense considerations, submarines and warships? I think what academics bring to government conversations is a bit of extra nuance, a little bit of extra background to say, perhaps we should be worrying a little bit more about this and a little bit less about that.
That's an excellent answer. Now, let's go back to your book, Lock, Stock, and Icebergs, which I would describe as a political history of the Northwest Passage. And you can contradict me here. Could you explain the title, please? Where does it come from?
Well, it certainly is a political history. The title comes from Brian Mulrooney, actually. Quite fitting as I'm sitting in the Brian Mulrooney Institute of Government building here at St. FX. In the 1980s, during one of the periodic sovereignty crises between Canada and the United States, Brian Mulrooney had Ronald Reagan into Ottawa, and he was trying to convince him that the Arctic waters, the Northwest Passage, as it's commonly known, were Canadian. Lock, stock, and icebergs. There was no nuance. They were not Canadian territorial waters through which an American right of transit existed. They were not exclusive economic zones through which, you know, there were different competing international rights. They were internal historic waters. They were every bit as Canadian as the river flowing beneath Parliament Hill. Canadian, lock, stock, and icebergs. And I thought it was quite an apt title because it encapsulates Canadian policy and rhetoric in particular over the past, we could say, 70 years, probably even the last 120 years, depending how far you're willing to push it back. Going through House of Commons debates, listening to party leaders and prime ministers, the Canadian position has always been that the Arctic waters were entirely inalienably Canadian. Now, what this book does is it provides a bit of a narrative behind the scenes. Well, that's great. People like Mulrooney, people like Mackenzie King can go out and say, these are entirely Canadian waters. The big question is, why? How? On what basis? Now, the reality is, before Mulrooney at least, Canadian prime ministers for the better part of a century would tell their American colleagues, would tell their colleagues in the House of Commons that the Arctic waters were Canadian lock, stock, and icebergs. But if anybody asked them why, on what basis, what legal grounds do you claim that? The reality is they didn't often have an answer. So what this book is, it's a history of the Canadian government trying to find that answer over the last 100 years.
Now, before we move on, could you briefly explain for our audience, which is formed mostly of non-specialists like me in this area, what do you mean when you refer to the Arctic? I believe that most of our listeners imagine the Arctic as surrounding the North Pole. but how wide or how large is this area? And which are the southernmost localities included in it on the Canadian side and on the other side, if you know, you know? Also, what happens on the other side of the North Pole in Russian territory? And you mentioned Russia and China, but how about Sweden, Norway, and the Scandinavian countries? Are they also players in this Arctic area?
Of course. And anyone who is working in the field, writing about the Arctic, that's almost always the first question they have to answer. Now, the reality is there isn't a definition of the Arctic. There are multiple different definitions of the Arctic, and a biologist and a geologist and a politician, they're all going to use very different understandings of the region. And in fact, how you define the Arctic speaks volumes to what you're trying to work on, what you're trying to accomplish. So my book used a political definition of the Arctic, the three northern territories in Canada, and then of course the high Arctic islands, the Northwest Passage. That's my definition. But the definition could equally be based on population. Where are northern inhabitants living? It could be based on the tree line. Often the Arctic is simply bracketed off by different parallels or the isotherm. There are a dozen different definitions of what the Arctic is. A big part of that is that the Arctic, even geographically, if you were to draw a simple circle around the polar regions, is going to be radically different. So you mentioned the Scandinavians. Because of different differences of climate caused by currents, and various geological features, the Scandinavian region may be roughly parallel to the Canadian High Arctic, but environmentally radically different. And so the Scandinavian Arctic, which is the Arctic, is more akin in terms of temperature and vegetation to Northern Ontario in many respects. So what listeners have to remember is there isn't an Arctic. There is no one clear Arctic with a set of political, strategic, environmental problems or considerations. There are many different Arctics, and the Arctic can be defined many different ways.
Interesting. Adam, a question just popped up in my mind. When so many countries are involved in the Arctic and have a stake in it, is it full of resources? Is it a habitat for some Aboriginal groups, or is it a fishing resource? What's at stake here ultimately? Why do Canadians want to declare the Arctic theirs, and maybe the Russians also on the other side?
Well, there's a great deal of stake, Lavinia, but we come back to your first question too, and providing clarity, particularly to policymakers. There are some things that aren't at stake that people believe to be. Going back to, I would say, 2007, when people really started to pay attention with oil prices spiking before the recession, the peak oil theories circulating, gaining a lot of prominence. The U.S. Geological Survey published studies showing that an enormous amount of undiscovered oil was present in the Arctic. And in fact, the Arctic contained, a good chunk of what was left of the world's hydrocarbons. So all of a sudden, people were thinking of the Arctic as this contested basin where the Russians and the Canadians, the Americans, the Chinese, perhaps, would compete over resources. Now, 15 years later, give or take, we've realized, well, no, that's not the case at all. Now, that misconception is still circulating. You still hear people everywhere from the media to government saying, well, the Chinese or the Russians are after our oil. Well, no nonsense. Almost every natural resource in the Arctic is very clearly delineated within either territory or continental shelf. The Russians aren't going to challenge Canada's continental shelf because they have their own continental shelf that they don't want anybody to challenge. Now, the one exception might be something called the extended continental shelf. And if you Google overlapping Arctic claims, that's what you're going to get. The Danes from Greenland, the Russians, the Canadians, all have overlapping extended continental shelf, which legally means, if this claim is confirmed, we would be responsible for or have administration for the seabed resources. So all of the oil and gas at the North Pole and even beyond. And there's big overlap. The reality, however, is one, nobody wants this oil right now. And it's very unlikely that we're going to want it in the future because of the cost. What we've seen from offshore Arctic drilling, Shell, Gazprom, BP, Exxon, they have spent often tens of billions of dollars in failed attempts to drill wells 30 miles offshore, very, very close to oil infrastructure. These overlapping areas, these sources of conflict in theory, these are hundreds, even thousands of kilometers offshore into the Northwest Passage, into the Arctic Ocean around the polar basin and the North Pole. The cost of getting at these hydrocarbons would be astronomical. Unless we're looking at $300 oil, nobody's going there. The Russians, the Americans, the Canadians, we have plenty of much, much easier oil. Minerals, onshore deposits, all very much within accepted jurisdictions. There really isn't a race for resources. And so that's one of those narratives that I think a lot of academics, at least over the last 10 years, have tried to tamp down, like, no, there's not a threat. There are, however, emerging competitive areas. Fishing is one of them. It's one we don't think about quite as much. We think oil and gas in the Arctic, but fish. You now have salmon showing up in the middle of the Northwest Passage because the world's oceans are warming. China is a particular concern. China operates the world's largest illegal distant water fishing fleet. And of course, over the last 10 years, we've seen a rapacious Chinese appetite for illegal fishing around the Galapagos Islands, South America, off Africa. It's a very, very serious problem. Looking forward 10 years into the future, there's no reason to believe that that doesn't materialize in the Beaufort Sea. And that's something that we have to really take seriously. We're also seeing a lot of activity in the Northwest Passage that has never been there before. Everything from big cruise ships with 1,000 people on them. I've been on a couple of these, very, very well run. But if something goes wrong, the question is, how do you rescue 1,000 people? And I'm afraid the answer is you don't. I can tell you, I slept with my boots on as we transited through some of the more dangerous sections of the Northwest Passage because I was ready to get to the lifeboats. I mean, it's a dangerous thing to do. You've also got a whole new category of people moving through the Arctic, what I would call yahoos, idiots in sailboats, skidoos, kayaks, canoes. These are people who are constantly being saved by the Coast Guard. These are people that do not register. They're not reporting on AIS systems. We don't know precisely where they are. They're constantly getting into trouble. Now, this is a real consideration and even strategic questions. So you ask, well, why do we care if the Northwest Passage is Canadian? Well, if it's Canadian, we get to regulate it, which means we get to control these yahoos, means we get to control shipping, which means we have much greater control over environmental preservation in these very delicate waters. And it means that we get to control access by foreign state vessels. The Arctic, as a transit route, an international strait, means the Chinese, the Russians can sail right on through. It's something we traditionally have not wanted. As Canadian waters, that's not a right.
Your book is an engaging read, although you do include a wealth of historical information that explains the twists and turns involved in Ottawa's claim over the Arctic waters between around 1880 up until the 1980s. Your colleague, Dr. Peter Kickert, wrote this in his review of your book, and I'm citing here. La Jeunesse focuses on the evolution of Canadian thinking on three interconnected issues: how to define Canada's Arctic waters, how to legally and politically justify a claim to those waters, and how to advance an official claim on the international stage, end of quote. In exploring these themes, he further writes, you take the reader on a journey through the historic legal thinking of Canadian officials as they try to build a case for Canada's sovereignty over the Arctic waters, and you explain the key areas that have defined Canadian policy. And Peter further writes, in charting a course through these legal developments, La Jeunesse highlights the complex interplay between law, diplomacy, and state practice that has shaped Canada's Arctic policy. Could you take us briefly through your argument as you presented in the book?
Yes, the core question there is about complexity. And that is what the book was trying to convey. And also to dismiss certain basic understandings of Arctic sovereignty as a dichotomous, we have it or we don't. A use it or lose it, as Stephen Harper said, or lock, stock, and icebergs, as Brian Mulroney once said. Now, the reality is sovereignty is not something that can simply be achieved through force of presence. You don't send 10 icebreakers into the Northwest Passage and say, well, that helps our sovereignty. You don't yell at an American president and say, oh, that's being strong, we're protecting our sovereignty. The reality is that securing sovereignty in the Arctic, or even defining what our sovereignty in the Arctic even is this complex interplay of strategic and legal and political questions. So to give you an example, in the 1950s, Canada was trying to figure out how it could claim sovereignty in the Arctic. We knew we wanted it. When I say sovereignty of the Arctic, I mean the waters. How do we claim these waters? And so for years, external affairs pored over international legal precedents, laws, the law of the sea, to try and find some vehicle by which it could claim these waters. Politically, doing that was a very real problem because the United States, which was at the time and remains today the main proponent of the freedom of navigation around the world, was very much opposed to any country claiming more than what the U.S. thought was an appropriate and legal amount of territory and water, I should say, maritime territory. And it wasn't just the Arctic. The Americans were now in the 1950s and the 1960s very interested in unilateral maritime extensions of territory from the Philippines, the Indonesians, all over the world. And so when Canada would go to the U.S. to say, look, you know, we feel that these Arctic waters should be Canadians, the Americans were not looking at the Arctic waters. They were looking at Indonesia and saying to the Canadians, if we give you this, like, well, first off, we don't particularly care about the Arctic. We'd like to give you that. But there are these huge international principles at stake. And so if we are seen to be going along with a Canadian claim in the Arctic, then that's going to really hurt us all around the world. And so that is one of the main political and strategic drivers that has always been with Canada, because we have always had to, or felt that we had to, convince the Americans to come along with us, to accept, or at the very least not challenge Canada's claim. Because the nightmare scenario was always that Canada moves forward and says, the Arctic is Canadian, we are legislating control over those waters. And then the next day to have an American icebreaker sail through conducting a freedom of navigation voyage. How do you stop that? It's very embarrassing. It's very politically damaging. And of course, we didn't want to hurt our relationship with the Americans. There's a lot going on in the Arctic. There are enormous defense projects we are building with the United States. There are American submarines sailing through, doing things that, frankly, we wanted them to do. And so throwing a monkey wrench into that relationship and injecting the political and legal question of sovereignty would throw off a functional working relationship, which during the Cold War was a very important one. There were even domestic reasons. Over many years, the Canadian government pushed the sovereignty question in the Arctic back because it wanted to focus on more important waters, the Gulf of St. Lawrence, Dixon Entrance out west, Hecate Strait. For a long time, the Arctic was allowed to sort of become a tertiary priority as we pushed those more important claims. Legally, the Canadian government was always watching international precedent, watching what other countries were doing and trying to figure out a more appropriate way to package our sovereignty. You know, we started with the fundamental understanding that the northern waters were ours. Figuring out how to prove that, how to back that up in international law, was a constantly changing dynamic, because of course international law was constantly changing over the course of the Cold War. Three Law of the Sea conventions, the nature of historic internal waters, international straits, always changing. And of course, external affairs is watching that and saying, well, how do we fit what we want into this changing legal dynamic? So all of those different factors came to play together.
So, Adam, you explain why the Arctic is important to Canada, but what do the Russians have to say about Canada asserting sovereignty or claims over part of the Arctic? What's the Russian position in this respect?
Well, there's a curious irony there, Lavinia, where if you were to ask, who is Canada's probably only major ally when it comes to our political claims to the Arctic waters, I would tell you it's the Russians. Over the course of the Cold War, the Russians have never been particularly friendly to Canada, and I would say today that tradition holds true. But in this particular instance, there's a confluence of interests here. So the way Canada has ultimately decided to legislate our sovereignty over the Arctic waters is to draw what are called strait baselines, basically lines on the map around the northern archipelago, the Queen Elizabeth Islands, and to say within those lines, all of these waters are historic Canadian waters. Now, the Russians have never objected to this because they have their own Arctic archipelagos. Little different, geographically different, historically different, smaller, but they have done much the same thing, drawn straight baselines around those archipelagos and claimed the waters within as entirely Russian. Now, there's never been any formal understanding between the Russians and the Canadians, but I have seen documents from the 1970s where, let's say, informal conversations were recorded between external affairs and the Russians, whereby the Canadians said, what do you think of our claim? To which the Russians responded, what do you think of our claim? Then it's agreed. We'll all just sort of live and let live and get along. There's a bit of a you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours agreement, implicit agreement between the Canadians and the Russians there not to challenge one another's, which is why you will never see a Canadian ship challenging those Russian strait baselines, which is why I don't think I've ever seen a Canadian government official say that, you know, Russia's historic waters and baseline claims in the Arctic are nonsense. And so you've actually got our main enemy on side politically, while our main ally, the United States, has been the chief antagonist for the Canadian claim. It has been the country that we have been most concerned about a challenge from. So it's a curious little reversal of roles from an Arctic perspective.
So should I understand that no Russian submarine is entering Canadian Arctic waters?
Well, that's an interesting question, Lavinia. I can't give you an answer to that one. They don't tell me when they sail up there. Russian submarine operations are obviously very secret. There's some indication that they may have been in the Canadian waters in the 1970s and 1980s, but there's certainly no proof of that. Now, we do know that American submarines have been up many times. There's some records of the U.S. There's at least 9 recorded submarine transits through Canadian waters, but the American transits at least took place with Canadian participation. I doubt the Russians did.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can you tell me a bit about the research process that went into your book? When and why did you become interested in the Arctic as a topic for research? And what convinced you that a new book on the Arctic was even necessary?
Well, I became interested in the Arctic in early 2000s, right before people started to care about the Arctic. Around 2005, people started to sort of wake up and realize, well, global warming and oil prices, the Arctic may be back in geopolitical economic play. And so I was just ahead of that curve. And I recall thinking, well, there has not been a real recent history of these very important Arctic waters. And like you said, this is a political history of the Northwest Passage, a very important body of water. Politically, very complex situation. There has been work done on this before. Sheila Grant, Elizabeth, Betsy Elliott Meisel, but those works were a bit older. And one of the big problems they suffered from was lack of documentation. So, I mean, you talk about research. This book was an extraordinarily difficult book to research because the Canadian government is sensitive about this subject for obvious reasons, because legally and politically, it's still a bit of a hot potato. And the government doesn't want to give up documentation, even dating back to the 1950s, prying government reports, memoranda out of the Library and Archives of Canada required extensive access to information requests over many, many years. And so I think where my book adds a lot is, you know, 10 years of that kind of archival research, digging thousands and thousands of new pages out of the government's clenched fists. And I can tell you, at one point when this book was going to press, I received a package of documents from Canadian government that I had requested in 2005. So that was over 10 years that it took them to get me this material. I requested those documents as a master's student, and it came out 10, 11 years later, which gives you an idea of quite how long sometimes it takes to get this stuff. Now, that being said, I've always said, well, in the 2030s, some enterprising graduate student is going to completely delegitimize my book because there's so much more out there. There's an enormous amount of material that we don't have from the 1960s onwards. So someday there will be, you know, the next iteration of this. And of course, there's huge areas we know so little about. So submarines, you mentioned. This book does more than anything out there to track the history of American submarine operations in the Arctic. And all of that came from one archive where I showed up and I said, well, you have this collection, I'd like to see it. Well, I don't think we do. Unless you do, I've seen on the internet some reference to it. So they went down to the basement and sure enough, they found it. I don't know if it's declassified yet. No, it is. I'm sure it is. I didn't really know, but it's important to act confident. So this fellow was either tired that day or he was retiring next week. So he said, here you go. And I got reams and reams and reams of American documentation on naval operations, which was classified the next year. So obviously it was not supposed to be given to me. But, you know, there's luck. A lot of that is just luck. A lot of it is just asking so many times that someone makes a mistake and gives you documents that the last five guys didn't give you. And it's just perseverance and trying from different angles to get all this material. And like I said, in the 2030s, when it's just old enough, there will be some PhD student that redoes this and adds a much fuller account. Because of course, there's so much missing from this story.
So besides, you made good use of a number of archival collections. But besides archival documents, did you reach out to any policymakers who were key in the Canadian government institutions dealing with the Arctic to interview or to have discussions with them?
I certainly looked. The problem with dealing with history is that people tend to pass away. And the book ends in 1985, effectively. Well, it sort of goes up to 1990, but effectively it sort of stops when Canada makes its claim to the Arctic waters under the Mulroney government. And previous to that, almost every major policy actor has passed away. So most of the people who I'd like to speak to, unavailable.
In the book, you talk about the unspoken political agreement between the United States and Canada that has prevented this sovereignty dispute from damaging the relationship between these two countries. Is this still in effect?
It absolutely is. I call it, it's been called an agreement to disagree. I've called it Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I think it's a better way of looking at it. Historically, we're dating back to the early 1950s, late 1940s. The underpinning international relations approach was if Canada doesn't, or if America doesn't ask Canada which waters it claims as its own, Canada's not going to have to tell them, and we can just avoid that whole messy circumstance. Because as soon as the Americans are forced to request permission to send cargo ships or submarines into our waters, we are forced to clarify our position. And that clarity creates conflict because neither side can afford to surrender on the fundamentals of their point. And so that has, in one respect or another, it's changed, but in one respect or another, it has remained the case to this day. Now, we saw a bit of a speed bump back when Donald Trump was president. And I wrote a piece with a colleague, Rob Hubert, which said, this 70-year-old policy framework looks like it's about to fall apart. Because the entire don't ask, don't tell principle is based on a certain professionalism within the both governments and an understanding that rocking the boat is not going to help anybody. This is not about winning your position. It's about keeping an equilibrium where everyone is pretty happy. And so under the Trump administration, we saw some very concerning and interesting things coming out of the Secretary of the Navy, a man named Richardson, and the chiefs of operations in the U.S. Navy that were saying, we're going to run freedom of navigation voyages through the Canadian Arctic. We're going to challenge Canadian sovereignty. You know, we're going to win. Well, the Americans haven't been trying to win this dispute for decades for very good reasons. Now, as soon as the Americans conduct one of these freedom of navigation voyages, the Canadian government would be forced to either stop that ship or take it to court. Like, we would be at the international court, or there would be some very serious ramifications which would damage Canadian relations. It would damage Canadian-American cooperation, defense cooperation in the Arctic. It would have knock-on ramifications that affects trade policy, immigration policy, all kinds of relationships with the United States would be damaged. And this is why we have tried to push this disagreement to the side for decades and decades. Now, what actually happened was the operators in the United States, so not the politicians, not those who are appointed to high command, but the Coast Guard and the Navy and the State Department, people who have been there for a very, very long time, were able to get a hold of their bosses and say, look, this is a bad idea. There's a reason we haven't done this ever. Here are the consequences. And I think they thought twice about it. But there was, for a moment there, for a year or so, there was very real concern that old comfortable framework that has worked for so long was about to fall apart.
Canada's presence in the North is shown as somewhat off and on with military activities starting and stopping in the 1950s and again in the 1980s. Are we still seeing that pattern today?
We're not, actually. You're right about the historical pattern. Canadian armed forces have popped up north for 5 or 10 years, depending on the crisis of the day. But over the last, I would say, 20 years, starting particularly in 2002, and accelerating during the Harper years, really, we have seen a real concerted effort to maintain and sustain a presence in the north. Now, that doesn't mean that the Canadian Navy or the Army is always there. That's just not an effective way to operate. But there's an understanding that the Canadian Armed Forces has a persistent role to play. They're up there every summer when the ice melts. We are conducting a lot more winter operations. There really isn't any indication that that presence is going to fade. And of course, given the increased shipping opportunities in the north, given the new concern over climate change and the opening waters and the new activity, it's very unlikely that you're going to see the Canadian Armed Forces pull back. If anything, that presence is only going to increase. The Navy's got 3 Arctic offshore patrol ships. We have got several more being built, a couple more for the Coast Guard as well. The Canadian fleet and its northern capabilities is only going to expand over the next 10 years.
Let me remind our listeners that we are talking today with Dr. Adam Lajeunesse about his book, Lock, Stock and Icebergs, A History of Canada's Arctic Maritime Sovereignty, which was published with University of British Columbia Press in 2016. This book is the first in-depth history of U.S. submarine operation in the Arctic, and there appears to have been a lot of that activity, with the Arctic gaining strategic value in the 21st century. Are those operations likely to come to see a comeback?
Well, I think they definitely are. If you look at the U.S. Navy's recently released Arctic policy, it falls in line with the national security strategy, which is very defense heavy. Several years back, the U.S. Navy released an Arctic strategy that was very cautious about the potential for strategic competition. The focus was on cooperation, on the environment, on sustainability, and only, you know, in a couple of years, the Navy recast that entire strategy and focused on strategic competition. In fact, the head of the U.S. Navy was asked by a reporter, like, why would you make that shift? Why rewrite your whole strategy and change it so quickly? And his answer was just, well, the damn thing melted. The Arctic was melting. That is what forced our revision. And there has been a big revision and a lot of interest in the U.S. government. The U.S. Army, Coast Guard, Air Force, Navy, the DOD, and the White House have all put out Arctic strategies over the last 2 to 4 years. So huge emerging interest from the Americans. So you're going to see a lot more surface and subsurface activity. The Russians very recently put out their new maritime strategy, which highlighted the Arctic as a strategically central role to their national security. So there's no question that the Arctic is going to remain probably the most important maritime region for the Russian Navy as well. The Chinese are a bit of a wild card. They have 2 icebreakers and they're planning on building a 3rd, potentially nuclear powered one, which would be, you know, quite impactful. But how they use those ships and whether or not they develop a strategic interest in the Arctic, well, that very much remains to be seen.
The book talks about the U.S. as Canada's legal and political opponent in the sovereignty debate. Is that still the case, or is Chinese and global interest in the Arctic playing a new role?
Well, it is still the case with the United States. And in fact, if you go back to Stephen Harper's first day on the job as prime minister, he opened that tenure with a press conference where he chastised the American ambassador, who had, you know, very recently reiterated the longstanding American position that the Northwest Passage is an international strait. And Stephen Harper said, look, we got our mandate from the Canadian people, not the American ambassador. And it was points scoring. pure and simple, but you know, it's very recent in the grand scheme of things. And it shows that this is still very much alive. And if you look at any American Arctic strategy, Barack Obama's, George W. Bush, there's always that reiteration of their longstanding position that the Northwest Passage and the Russian Northern Sea Route are international waters, or that there is an international strait running through. So that longstanding dispute, it's very well managed, but the longstanding dispute is still there. Now, the Chinese position is very interesting. It's purposefully ambiguous. The Chinese released an Arctic policy in 2018, I believe it was, where they said that they recognize Canadian and Russian sovereignty to all of the waters over which those countries have a legal right to claim. Something along those lines. I can't recall the precise wording, but it was worded in such a way as to say, we recognize your sovereignty in areas where you have sovereignty, without clarifying what areas you had sovereignty. So the Chinese are trying to walk a very fine line. On the one hand, they don't want to recognize those maritime claims because they may... international travel, international shipping is very important to China, and they want to keep that open for the future. But at the same time, they don't want to antagonize the Canadians and the Russians, whose support they need for Arctic operations. China has used the Northwest Passage. It sent an icebreaker through several years back. We regularly send cargo ships through that passage to China, and creating a fight, a political challenge, it doesn't do anything for China. So China has walked that comfortable fine line, neither challenging nor accepting either Canadian or Russian state sovereignty over those regions.
How about the Scandinavians? How about the Greenland and the Scandinavian countries that border on the Arctic area? Do they have any presence, or do they have any, or are they are too small international actors to really matter in comparison to the Canadians, Americans, and the Chinese in the Arctic?
Well, it's not so much that they don't matter, Lavinia. It's that they have comfortably outsourced the job of challenging Canada's claim to the United States, as many countries have. So in the 1970s, when there was a political dispute over the voyage of an ice-breaking supertanker, the Manhattan, and again during the 1980s, the Canadian Department of External Affairs was watching other countries, the Japanese, the French, the British, many of the Germans, West Germans at the time, many of whom didn't necessarily support or respect Canada's claim. But none of those countries came out and said, this is incorrect, we don't recognize these claims, because why would they bother? They don't want to ruffle Canadian feathers. They don't want to get into a fight if they don't need to. They're very happy. Historically, they've been very happy to let the Americans fight that fight. They've outsourced that to the US, which they know is going to maintain that American position and broadly, and broader position that the Northwest Passage is an international strait.
Very interesting. What opportunities do you see for Canada to expand its control and defense of the Arctic?
Well, we're actually doing quite a lot right now. The Navy is producing one new Arctic and offshore patrol ship every year. We're getting an awful lot of those coming off the ways now. We have three, I believe, in the water. The Coast Guard is getting a couple. There are plans for new icebreakers. So both the Coast Guard and the Navy fleets are expanding, or will be expanding quite significantly over the next, well, at present, up to maybe 10 years from now, where hopefully we should get a heavy icebreaker or two. Now, we've been promised those heavy icebreakers for the last 15 years, so I won't, I'm going to hedge when I say we're getting them. But at least the patrol ships are being actively built right now. They're very capable. We are going to see, six patrol ships up in the Arctic in the next 3 to 4 years. I think we'll be up to about six Navy vessels that are going to maintain a significant presence, a constabulary capability, a whole of government response capability, Canadian surveillance is improving with satellite capability, Canadian communications up north, ground-based surveillance. NORAD is being modernized. What exactly that looks like, we don't know yet, but the Canadian government has pledged an initial $5 billion. So there is a lot happening. There's a lot of money being spent. There's a lot of steel being cut to actually, for the first time since the 1980s, to really put our ships where our mouth has been on Arctic sovereignty.
As the Arctic warms, where do you see challenges emerging to Canadian sovereignty now?
Well, sovereignty, you have to understand, is not simply a question of presence. Sovereignty is a legal question which represents or which implies a state's right, its recognized right to exercise absolute sovereignty within a given area. And so, as I've said before to policymakers and journalists, that you do not win sovereignty by sticking more icebreakers up in the Arctic. The Americans will not wake up one day and say, well, let's recognize Canada's claim. They're up to 10 ships. We weren't going to recognize it at 9, but now they have 10. It doesn't work that way. That presence that we have, that the ships, the surveillance, that capability, that is not sovereignty per se. That is stewardship that allows us to fulfill all of the obligations of a sovereign state. Those obligations being search and rescue, environmental preservation, jurisdictional enforcement, criminal law enforcement, fisheries protection, all of the things that you would expect from a sovereign state operating in their own waters. Now, as the Arctic warms, as I said earlier, we're going to see a lot more operations. We're going to see a lot more activity, cruise ships, pleasure craft, everything from the enormous 1,000-person cruise vessels moving through down to, you know, adventurers going through on skidoos and kayaks and things like that. You're going to see a lot of, you know, criminal activity. You're going to see a lot of trespassing. You're going to see potentially illegal immigration. That's pretty rare, but there actually have been a few instances of attempted illegal immigration coming in through the Arctic. As the Arctic warms, you're also going to have a lot more environmental issues, not just the melting ice, but so much of Canada's infrastructure, our communities are built on permafrost. There's going to be serious problems maintaining transportation infrastructure all the way down to, you know, individual homes. We're going to figure out how we resupply those areas better. We're going to have to figure out how we build in the Arctic better. We're going to have to figure out how to communicate in the Arctic better, because we still don't have reliable internet or reliable communications, telecommunication systems across the North. So climate change is going to change a lot about the Canadian North, and not just from a security perspective, but from a development perspective, a human perspective, a delivery of service perspective. The Arctic is going to look very different in 20 years from now.
Adam, your argument is centered on law and politics. What about the people living in the Arctic? Is it important for them if Canada, Russia, the US, China, or some other power asserts sovereignty? Or they wish for self-determination, and from their point of view, it doesn't really matter what state is there?
Well, historically, the people of the Arctic, and we have to generalize here because there is no one uniform opinion or even one uniform people of the Arctic. The Arctic is comprised not only of white settlers or southern settlers, but of many different, you know, cultural, linguistic, you know, historical groups, very, very, you know, separate opinions about development and about the state. But if we're going to generalize, historically speaking, the people of the Arctic have been very much in favor of a strong Canadian state position on sovereignty. The reason being is that state position, that the Northwest Passage is entirely Canadian, lock, stock, and icebergs, that allows Canada to regulate those waters very strictly. So who can go through? Shipping lanes, environmental regulations. This is very much to the benefit of Northerners because the alternative is IMO regulations, which govern global waterways, which are not as strict. And so in the 1980s, for instance, when the U.S. icebreaker Polar Sea went through the Northwest Passage, it sort of kicked off the political a fight between the Americans and the Canadians, which led Mulroney to tell Reagan that it's lock, stock, and icebergs. One of the things which forced the Canadian government to respond to that was the Inuit organizations saying, you know, if the Canadian state is so weak that they can't protect the Arctic, then maybe we should, you know, look to other alternatives. We ought to do it ourselves. We, you know, there was criticism of the Canadian state coming from the Inuit for not taking a firmer position on that. And that, you know, somewhat shamed and pressured and contributed to the federal government actually turning this into a bit of a fight.
If you were to rewrite that book, or publish a second updated version, what would you change, if everything, or if anything? What was left out of the book and merited inclusion in the second edition?
You know, I think it stands fairly well. And that's one of the joys of writing history, is you can write something and be fairly certain that it's going to stand 10 years into the future. I write quite a bit of international history, international relations, strategic studies work on China's Arctic interests, Russian geopolitics. And I know that that's going to be out of date in a year. Events will render that out of date very, very quickly. But the history here is quite solid. And until, like I said, the next enterprising individual comes and digs out the next batch of government documents to prove me wrong, I think it stands fairly well.
So your future plans when it comes to research on the Arctic is, you know, looking for new archival treasures somewhere that you can access, or where would you go in the next 5 years, to say, when it comes to your research on the Arctic?
Well, over the next 5 years, there's a couple of very related projects that I'm working on. The first is a history of icebreaker operations in the 1950s. And it's kind of an adventure story. There's a lot of histories out there of early Arctic explorers, Victorian explorers and wooden ships, you know, dramatic stories. But for some reason in the 1950s, historians tend to say, I guess the exploration is all done. You know, it's all over now. Not the case at all. Really incredible stories from the 1950s as the Americans and the Canadians learn to operate in the north. Hundreds and hundreds of ships sent north on defense research and construction projects, literally hundreds. And the Americans will send 300 vessels, and about seven of them will come back undamaged at the end of the operation. A couple will have sunk, a couple will have grounded, and maybe 100 or so will have suffered serious damage. Several men chopped up by helicopter accidents. I mean, just an incredible adventure story from those early years of modern exploration. That's one of the next big projects, to tell that story, the history of learning to operate in the Arctic, of modern exploration. And of course, the next big book is a continuation of the history of Arctic submarine operations. And that's just a continuous 10 to 20 year process of trying to pry documentation out of various government bodies. You know, I've discovered a lot more since writing this book, but not quite enough for a follow-up. So you'll have to ask me in 10 years how that's gone.
That's very exciting, and for sure I'll keep this in mind. Our guest today at New Books Network was Professor Adam Lajeunesse, the author of Lock, Stock, and Icebergs, A History of Canada's Arctic Maritime Sovereignty, a book published with University of British Columbia Press in 2016. Thank you again, Adam, and goodbye.
Thanks very much, Lavinia.